So we're going to continue the theme this morning of talking a bit more about meditation, but specifically I'm going to talk about what we call jhana practice, or the jhanas. That's the Pali word. In Sanskrit it's dhyana. I just stick to Pali because I find it easier, but you may be more familiar with dhyana, and people talk about dhyanic states and the realm of the jhanas, but I'll use jhana, same thing. And jhana is usually translated as meditation, which is actually incorrect. It's actually a technical term for specific experiences that are reached in a progressive way through certain concentrated mental states. But there's also a root meaning to jhana as well, which has an association with fire or burning up. So there's a sense of burning up anything adverse through practicing the jhanas. That's an important thing to remember. It's not just about meditation. There's actually a root of we're actually burning up specifically things like the hindrances, which I'll talk a bit more about later. So what are the jhanas? Well, fundamentally they're 8 altered states of consciousness brought on by concentration. So we become progressively more concentrated and we experience different states of consciousness. That's what the jhanas are. And some of you may well have experienced them when you've been meditating, but not put a label on them, not recognised what they are. But what's really important to remember as well is that they are still simply mundane states of consciousness. And in that sense, they're no big deal. They just occur and arise naturally when you become more concentrated. That's what the jhanas are. And equally important to remember is that the jhanas are only a means, albeit a skillful means, but they're not the end. And in the life story of the Buddha, we see this when he, before he became the Buddha with his 2 earlier teachers, when he was taught advanced states of meditation. Effectively, those 2 teachers took him to the point of the 1st 4 and then the 2nd 4 jhanas and said, that's it, you're enlightened. And Gautama, as was, said, actually, there's a lot more than this. And as most of you know, he left those teachers because he said, that is not it. Just being in these altered states of consciousness is not enlightenment. And there are still some teachers today who still incorrectly teach that, yeah, if you can master that, that's it, you haven't got to do anything else. But the Buddha obviously saw straight through that and moved beyond it relatively quickly. He mastered what those 2 teachers had to teach and moved on, even though they offered him the opportunity to co-lead with them. Another thing with the jhanas, and there's an important distinction, is you may hear people talking about 2 different sets of jhanas. So there's what I would call the sutta jhanas that come from the Pali canon, from the suttas. And there's the Visuddhimagga jhanas, which is a big long word. Visuddhimagga would translate loosely as path of purification. And it's a really good text that summarises and interprets the Buddha's teachings as found in the Pali canon, but it's not a text that's canonical, doesn't come from the early teachings. The Visuddhimagga was written around the 5th century by a chap called Buddha Ghosha, who went from India to Ceylon, as was now Sri Lanka. It's about 850 pages from memory, so it's pretty weighty. It's not the sort of book that you would just read from cover to cover, but it's an invaluable guide and commentary to the Pali canon, and especially meditation. But the Visuddhimagga jhanas are based more on a depth of concentration and a focus on concentration as having to be present for a long, long time. I'm not talking 10, 20 minutes, I'm talking hours. So when you read the jhanas as summarised in the Visuddhimagga, it says, and you stay in a concentrated state for half a day, and then you may just edge towards the first jhana. The sutta jhanas are much quicker and more in line with actually what the Buddha taught, as far as we know. That being said, really good read of the Visuddhimagga if you're up for it. Even if you want to dip in and dip out, there's a lot of fantastic commentary on the text, especially on meditation. But this morning I want to talk quite practically about how to experience the jhanas, especially the first four, and how to move between them. And it's something that's not discussed that often in our tradition about, well, how do you know when you're in a jhanic state? How do you experience it? How do you move towards it? So I'm going to kind of explain how it was taught to me, how I practice it, how I practiced it with others, both inside and outside of our tradition. And I'll mention one of the teachers who's taught me a lot of ways to explain or express the jhanas, which hopefully will prove useful. So one of the main ways that you start is simply through normal meditation, when you can start meditating on the breath, which almost everyone in here has done a number of times or many times. But as with all meditation, as most of you know, it's not just about the breath. You can equally start with metta practice as well. One of the good things about Buddhism, one of the things that I love, is there's no rules. You can just take all these experiences of others and put it into your own life, into your own experience, and see what works for you. What works for someone else won't necessarily work for you. So some people will start a practice with metta because it always works, kindness or friendliness. Others will want to start with the breath because it helps them feel more grounded. But it's entirely up to yourselves. And if I'm using the breath, for example, one of the things that I will do if I'm specifically sitting to do some jhana practice is, as distractions arise, I'll start to label them. Oh, that was thinking. Oh, that was planning. And I'll just use the first word that comes into my mind, so I won't spend, oh, what was that? Was that thinking? Or maybe that was planning? I'll just use the first thing that arises, just to label the distraction. And by doing that, what happens over a period of time is the distractions start to lessen, because you're actually making a conscious effort to name them, to clock, to acknowledge what's going on. And it's kind of a cycle. You label it, you relax, you come back to the breath or to metta, and then carry on. Another distraction arises, you label it, relax, concentrate, and keep going on. And gradually the concentration will become deeper. And in time, and it's a period of time which is different for everyone, and if you're on a longer retreat, you may find you can move into a more concentrated state more quickly than you can if you're just meditating at home amongst all the other distractions and things that you have to do in your life. But in time, you move into what is known as access concentration. The technical term for that is upachara samadhi. But that's actually not in the Pali canon at all. It doesn't actually exist in the Pali canon. That's a phrase that was used from the Visuddhimagga, but it's actually used to describe what we call access concentration. And samadhi is a word that you've probably heard around concentration, but upachara is a term that has this fluidity, this sense of movement, this sense of possibility and access. So hence the phrase upachara samadhi. And there's various signs when you are reaching this stage of concentration. There are various signs or nimittas which you may become aware of. And again, there's not a one size fits all. You may all experience this differently. Some people who are very visual would experience a sense of white light. So even with your eyes closed, you may just experience a sense of whiteness and a real depth. Other people, the breath may get very subtle, and that's how it is for me. And if you think of the mindfulness of breathing practice in the fourth stage, and if it's gone really well and you're focused on that subtle sensation of the breath as it enters the nostrils or when it comes out, if you're really, really focused and you can just sense the breath, that's almost a good description for access concentration. You're at a level where the background distractions have gone to a larger degree, and you're just aware of the breath as it flows in and out, or sensation on the top lip, wherever you tend to feel that in that practice. So that's a useful kind of marking point to think, okay, keep going from that point. And I find personally it also helps to start the practice, if I'm sitting to try and work with jhanas, to start with a slight smile on your face, even if you don't feel like smiling. And you know, important phrase here, fake it till you make it. And I'll say more on why smile later. There is a reason for my madness generally. I'll say a bit more about that later. Another way that you can practice this as well is you can also use body awareness, and that's a very useful method to move towards access concentration. It's a very useful way to become aware of what's happening in the whole body and just allow your attention to rest on the experiences that are happening in the body, whether you're feeling stress or anxiety manifesting around the shoulders or the heart area, whether you're feeling, if you're feeling any anxiety around the lower belly, even if you're experiencing some physical discomfort, sometimes it's a really good way, by using body awareness, to move towards access concentration. So hopefully you're starting to get the sense there's not like a critical path that you must follow. You can use the breath, you can use metta, you can use body awareness, lots of different techniques. In fact, in the Visuddhimagga, it describes 30 different methods for gaining access concentration. Big long list. The Visuddhimagga is great for lists. So there's 30 different ways that it describes you can move towards access concentration. I sometimes use mantra as well to get concentrated, because when I'm chanting, I find it more easily removes distractions because I'm just concentrating on the sound or the sound symbols, as Sangharakshita has described them, especially during a prolonged period of chanting. If I can sit and chant for 15, 20, 25 minutes, I do find that I can become very concentrated relatively easily without the distractions keep on reoccurring just through the act of chanting. But obviously chanting can be a bit antisocial if you're in a shared household or it's 4:30 in the morning when I get up to sit. Don't think my wife and kids would be very happy if I was chanting. I might try it and see. No, I won't. I think that would just ignore them. But access concentration itself has a recognisable quality of alertness. It's you won't need to ask yourself, have I moved into access concentration, because you will recognise, you will have this alertness that you'll be able to acknowledge physically and mentally. Another important aspect of access concentration, in fact a fundamental piece of access concentration, what I touched on earlier on, is that we use it to abandon the hindrances. So the hindrances in Buddhism, there's five of them: craving, aversion, sleepiness, restiness, and doubt. Or the older translation would be sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. But craving and aversion just ring a bit easier. So the five hindrances, and when we move into states of higher concentration, these hindrances do fall away. We don't suffer from sleepiness or restlessness. We don't hold or harbour ill will. Our doubt slides away. So the act of becoming progressively more concentrated and alert removes the hindrances. Unfortunately, it's not permanent. So when you come out of that state of concentration, the hindrances reoccur. If only they could permanently go, we would stay in the state. But that's probably a higher practice. But that's an important marker also when you become aware, when you're in access concentration, is you will become aware that the hindrances have just slipped away, that you're not holding, you don't have any sensation of feeling sleepy or restless or having doubt in what you're doing. That will not be there. So that's an important sign, again, an important signpost that access concentration has arisen. So concentration itself is the ability to let your mind really settle, to not be easily distracted. So Lee Brusington, one of the teachers who's taught me a lot about the jhanas, he comes up with this great word, indistractability, which is not a word, but I think it's a really good description of that mental state. And as a rule of thumb, before moving on to the first jhana, as a rule of thumb, it's best to try and stay in access concentration for 10, 15, 20 minutes until you have a sense that it's really, really settled, until you're really concentrated in such a way you're aware that the hindrances have dissipated. And when you get to that point, you then look to notice a pleasant sensation that's arising. And you look to enjoy that pleasant sensation. And you do nothing else, you just enjoy the pleasant sensation. So you might find your smile increasing, moving from a fake smile, if you had to fake it, to something that's more genuine, to more authentic. And eventually what will happen is this pleasant sensation will intensify more and more. So what's a pleasant sensation? Well, again, it could be different for each of us. For me, quite often, it is this smile just has become this big Cheshire cat grin. But quite often, I'll feel it as warmth in the hands as well. That's probably the two places that I experience it the most, is either through the smile or in the hands. Other people experience it in the heart centre. Other people have a sense of lightness. So again, it's very different. It's a very personal experience. And it's down to your individual makeup as to where you will experience this pleasant sensation. So you've got concentrated to a point, and you just start to notice, oh, my hands feel really lovely and warm, and you know, and you feel really concentrated just to notice that sensation of the warm hands or the heat around the heart area. That's when the pleasant sensation has now started to present itself. And a phrase that I often use in access concentration is keep going. Because sometimes it's very easy to, or very tempting to try and move on from access concentration too quickly. And I use the phrase keep going to just say, just stay in access concentration a little longer. But one of the key things with jhana practice, it involves a lot of trial and error. You try it, you get it wrong, you try it, you get it wrong. Like meditation in general, you have to try different postures, you will try different meditation techniques, you'll try doing different types of meditation one after the other, depending on your mental states. And it's exactly the same with jhana practice. But I do find that phrase, keep going, very helpful personally when I'm thinking, okay, now I want to move on to the first jhana. Actually, I don't feel quite so concentrated. I've still got a bit of doubt or a bit of restlessness or anxiety. And I just use the phrase, keep going, just to keep staying in access concentration for longer. But if you do focus on this pleasant sensation, then you do move naturally into the first jhana. And a couple of key words. So in the first jhana arises when what we call piti and sukha. Pali words, the Sanskrit would be piti. I find Sanskrit really hard. I just stick to Pali, I don't know why. So piti and sukha. So when they co-arise, that's when you're in the first jhana. So piti translates as it's a physical release of energy. And if you had to do a short translation, you'd use something like rapture or glee. It often manifests as heat, especially for me. And piti is accompanied in the first jhana by sukha, which, funnily enough, is the opposite of dukkha. So sukha would translate as joy or happiness. And at this stage, generally speaking, piti is the dominant sensation. So you'll be more aware of this rapture or glee or this energetic release than you will of the happiness or the joy. But these are two very important signs that you'll be aware of when you're in the first jhana. And if you can sustain the piti and jhana, if you can sustain the piti and sukha, that's the first jhana. That's when you know you've arrived in the first jhana, when you've got this experience of rapture and glee. And the rapture may be really, really powerful. I'll say a bit more about that. But when you're also aware that you've got this intense joy and happiness, and if you can sustain that, if you become aware it's not dissipating after a minute or two, that means you've arrived in the first jhana. And the first jhana will come and find you. It's not as if you have to go hunting through it. You move into access concentration, you focus on the pleasant sensation, and all things going well, you'll then be aware of piti and sukha, the joy and the rapture arising, and then you will be in the first jhana. So you allow your concentration to sharpen through access concentration itself, and you notice the pleasant sensation. If you're concentrated enough for piti and sukha to naturally arise, one thing I can almost guarantee is you will be smiling at this stage. It's very hard to go in the first jhana and not smile. Try it out and see. So Lee Brazenton, who I did some jhana work with, he describes at this point as trying to set up a positive feedback loop with pleasure. So you're holding your mind up to pleasure, which is pleasant, which in turn leads to more pleasure, which is where piti and sukha erupt. So a very nice way of thinking about it, this positive feedback loop. One key thing to understand, though, in the first jhana is that thoughts will still arise. They will still be thought. And two more Buddhist words, a bit of a Pali lesson this morning, but two more Buddhist words which many of you will have heard of are present in the first jhana, and that's vitakka and vichara. Vitakka is the Sanskrit, is that right? Yeah, and vichara is the same in Sanskrit. So in the first jhana, there will still be thinking, but it's more background thinking. So the text uses these words, vitakka and vichara, and they're often translated poorly as initial thinking and sustained thinking. But in this specific context, it's more that vitakka is just thinking, and vichara is more examining. So you're having a thought, it's just a thought, and then you're subtly examining the contents of that thought. So this process of thinking is still apparent, albeit it's a little bit of a background process in the first jhana. There will still be thoughts. As I touched on earlier on, sometimes piti, this rapture or glee, comes on really strong. And you might have a physical response where you're shaking or vibrating. You may have this Cheshire Cat grin, which I normally experience. You might even find yourself laughing. And if this happens, the best thing to do is just take a deep breath. And the act of taking a deep breath lessens the intensity of the piti. So it's very straightforward. I remember I was on solitary earlier this year up in Ashdown Forest, and I just finished a couple of hours of sitting practice with about an hour of jhana practice. And I'd finished a practice, I'd stood up, I'd gone to make a cup of tea, and all of a sudden I just burst out laughing. And I could not stop laughing. I was trying to boil the kettle and my hand was shaking because I was laughing so much. I had tears rolling down my eyes and I was just laughing. And what had happened there is I'd finished a formal practice, but the PT had resurfaced. So I'd gone up and down, 1, 2, 3, 4, the first four jhanas, then 4, 3, 2, 1. Stayed in the first jhana, switched back to the breath, finished meditating, stood up, fancy a cup of tea. And then the PT experience had just erupted again, and I was just like this laughing mad Buddhist in this little hut in Ashdown Forest. If there'd been a webcam in there, people would have thought, great, let's get a few images of the mad Buddhist. Fortunately, it was a solitary. If people would have heard me laugh, they would have thought I was just some nutter, because I was literally non-stop laughing for 10 or 15 minutes. So it can be that intense. The PT experience can be that intense. If it is, take a breath, and it will lessen the PT. So that's a long way of saying PT itself, this rapture or glee, is not a particularly tranquil experience. And again, a general rule of thumb, difference for all of us, but aim to stay in this PT sukha state for no more than 10 minutes. If the PT is really strong, which it can be, you may just want to stay in it for a couple of minutes. Again, it just depends on what's happening. That depends on what you brought into the meditation practice. If you've been busy with work and family and everything else, or if you've been on a longer retreat, you may find that you can move into the access concentration in the first jhana very quickly. So it does depend a lot on the conditions. There's a lovely piece in the Majjhima Nikaya in the Mahasapura Sutta. Asapura was a place in northern India. And the sutta says, free from sensual desires, free from evil thoughts, he attains and abides in the first jhana of joy and pleasure, which is accompanied with reasoning, so translation for vitakka, and investigation, so vichara, and arises from seclusion. He suffuses, pervades, fills and permeates his body with pleasure, sukha, and joy, piti, which arise from seclusion. And there is nothing in all his body untouched by the pleasure and joy arising from seclusion. That's a lovely passage, and that sutta goes on to explain the other jhanas too. But the word I want to pick up on there is seclusion. Seclusion from what? Secluded from what? Well, basically, the seclusion refers to seclusion from the hindrances. So in this passage, the Buddha is saying that piti and sukha will arise when the hindrances are not present. So when you have managed to dissipate the hindrances to such a point, for these experiences to arise, for this concentration level to arise, then you are secluded from the hindrances. So how do you move from the first jhana to the second jhana? And again, you know, this could be a bit scientific and descriptive, but actually the whole process is very natural. When you're doing it, it's natural. You'll know when the time is right to move on. You just feel it in your being. So to move on to the second jhana, what you try and do is you focus on the sukha. You focus on the joy or the happiness. And in the second jhana, there's more gaps between thoughts. So I mentioned in the first jhana there were still thoughts. In the second jhana, there's more gaps. And as you move towards tranquility, the mind calms and you experience sukha more deeply. So when you're in this transition period, you'll find the thoughts will fade to a point. You focus on the sukha, on the joy, or the happiness. And suddenly you're in the second jhana. And one of the markers of the second jhana is there's no vitakka and vichara. So there is no thinking and trying to examine the thoughts. That is entirely gone when you're in the second, when you arrive in the second jhana. The second jhana is full of happiness, but there is still a little bit of piti. There is still a bit of rapture or glee in the background. But whereas the first jhana was predominantly piti and a bit of sukha, the second jhana you flipped it round and you've got more sukha and less piti. And the way that I can experience the second jhana is happiness seems to arise, it stays a while, then it falls away, and then it arises again, and then it falls away. And when that becomes a more steady experience where I'm feeling more tranquil and the happiness seems to level off, that's when I know I've got a solid second jhana. And you're probably still smiling at this stage as well. See, the smile was important. You're probably still smiling, but it may have turned down a bit. So the actual intensity of the smile may well have just turned down when you arrive in the second jhana. So the third jhana, there are eight, I'm going to talk about the first four, I'll touch on the last four, but the third jhana is a state of, how would I describe it, contentment, satisfaction, and a good word that I think is used in the text is wishlessness. You don't have a sense of wishing for anything else. You've arrived at a level of concentration where you're so content, where you're so satisfied, that there's nothing that you're wishing for. So how do you move from the second to the third jhana? Again, it's different, but you will know when the time is right to do that. You can take a breath, which will, as I mentioned, it will turn down the level of piti. Taking a breath will turn down the level of sukha as well, turn down that level of happiness. And look to recollect the time when you were really content, when you just felt really happy, when you had no desires, and you focus on that contentment, on that time when you experienced true contentment. And in the third jhana, there's no piti, there is no rapture or glee, that's entirely dissipated. And often the second jhana is felt at the heart centre. The third jhana that we're moving into is normally felt lower down the body, often here in the belly. It's a more grounded experience. And again, Lee Brazenton, who I studied this with, he observes that as we progress higher through the jhanas, the lower it manifests in the body. So the first jhana is more up here, and then the second jhana, you go up the jhanas, is more down here, the third jhana is more down here, and so on. So it's quite a nice movement that you'll get higher up the jhanas, it may manifest lower in the body. Not always the case, but it's quite a useful rule of thumb. And third jhana, you're probably still smiling too, but it might be one of these, a more serene, knowing smile. I mean, I think the smiling to me has been a key focus of jhana practice, because it just helps me realise when I'm ready to move from one stage to the next. So looking then into the fourth jhana, we're looking to move beyond contentment to what you could describe as a more neutral state, a state without joy and without pleasure. We might experience a sense of going down deeper, as I was just saying, the higher the jhana, we have a sense of going deeper into the body. You might have a sense of going down deeper, of falling, maybe even a sense of feeling isolated from others, or from your own, or from the environment where you are. You will notice your concentration is moving slowly downwards. and the smile has usually disappeared by now as we focus on quiet stillness. So that's a short description of the first four jhanas and a few tips or examples of how you may experience them and how you may work with the jhanas. And I kind of have a rule when trying to describe meditation experiences to only talk directly from what I've experienced and what I'm comfortable with. So I've got a lot of experience in the first four jhanas. I've got less experience in the second four jhanas. I have some, but not that much. So I will describe them briefly, but I'm not talking so much from my own experience. I've still got work to do, clearly. So the last four jhanas, the fifth to the eighth one, are collectively known as the arupa jhanas, which would translate as formless or immaterial state jhanas, I guess. Yeah, immaterial state jhanas. The first four jhanas are sometimes known as the rupa jhanas or the material jhanas. You may think that's a bit weird. What does material mean? Well, in the first four jhanas, you're still aware of your material, of your physical body. You're aware of the body. In fact, you use the body to experience the jhanas. That's how you have these signposts along the way, because you're aware of your concentration ratcheting up. You're aware of that in the body. You can feel the rapture in the body in the early jhanas. You experience the happiness with your body. So in the first four jhanas, they're called the material jhanas because you're still aware of the body. So transitioning from the fourth to the fifth jhana, the first thing you need is a very stable, very solid fourth jhana. So you need to have that sense of feeling deeply settled. You need to have that sense of the piti is totally gone, the sukha is gone, you're in this place of contentment and serenity. And once that feels very stable, you can then start to move your attention towards the boundaries of your being, and that's why these are called the immaterial states. You're going beyond the materiality, going beyond the limits as you think of them of the body. So you start to move your attention towards the boundaries of your being, and you expand these boundaries to fill the room. So you're progressively expanding further and further to fill the building all the way to the horizon. And this probably sounds a bit odd, but actually the way that it manifests for me is you just experience this vast empty space just appearing before you, a vast empty space. And when you experience that, you're in the fifth jhana. One of the markers for that is you have no sense anymore of the body, hence these are the immaterial jhanas. There's no sense of the body. And you just allow your attention to rest on that spaciousness. And you experience a kind of boundless, limitless space. And this is why this is called the realm of infinite space, the fifth jhana. Because you just experience this sense of limitless space. Which, as you know, comes up in some of the texts that we chant as well. And what we're doing here is we're expanding our consciousness to also become limitless. When we're looking to move from the fifth to the sixth jhana, we kind of realise that we can't be conscious of something that's limitless if our consciousness is still limited. So what we're actually doing here, we're looking to expand our consciousness to understand that more, so that our consciousness in turn becomes limitless. And when that happens, that's the sixth jhana. This is called the realm of infinite consciousness. So the sixth and the fifth jhana are both mental experiences that are perceived in a way that makes them seem external. So they are still mental experiences, but the way that we perceive them, being human beings, is that they seem external to us because we're experiencing infinite space, we're experiencing limitless consciousness. So I'm going to talk about these two. Moving to the seventh and eighth jhana, I'm referring to text here because I don't have such direct experience. The seventh jhana is known as the realm of no-thingness. You'll see it written nothingness. I prefer to say no-thingness. And what we do here is we place our attention on a sense of nothing, or a sense of no-thing would be more accurate. Some people will experience this as a blackness or a black static, and you will directly experience that. And this no thingness, it's like there is no thing there. As Lee said when I was joining with him, it's like an empty biscuit tin. So there's a tin, but there's nothing in it. There's no thing in the tin. And some people describe fear arising at this stage. And an important thing to remember here, there's nothing to be afraid of because there's nothing there. So this seventh jhana really is about no thingness and having this direct sense of this direct sense of nothing, this direct sense of there not being anything for you to focus on, to even pay a minute microsecond of attention to. There is just no thingness. It is this empty biscuit tin. You open it and there is just nothing in there. So the eighth jhana is the realm of perception and non-perception, sanya, be a word that you may be more familiar with, Pali word. The realm of perception or non-perception. And this is a space that has no characteristics by which you can identify it. It's very subtle. And we're allowing the nothing that we experience in the seventh jhana to collapse, to totally dissipate. And we realise that there are no characteristics to identify anything whatsoever with. We can't even identify a nothing. We've gone beyond that. And I'm told this is a very fragile jhana, and often it necessitates going back to the seventh, sixth, or even the fifth jhana just to get some more stability before you work back up. And in the suttas, the Buddhas describe this, especially in the Parinibbana Sutta, where it describes the Buddha as he was approaching death, going up and down through the jhanic states. And it's a very useful way of doing the practice. So that's the description, really, of the first four and the second four jhanas. A bit more context around it is the jhanas show up in many suttas. So 50 suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, so that's a third, mention jhanas. 17 or 18 suttas in the Digha Nikaya mention jhanas. That's half, 50% of the suttas in the Digha Nikaya. So a third of suttas in the Majjhima, half of the suttas in the Digha Nikaya mention jhanas. So that's how often they're talked about. And at the end of many suttas, in the Pali, you'll see the Buddha will say, "And go jayati," which is a derivation, that's where the word jhana comes from. So at the end of the suttas, the Buddha wasn't just saying, "Go meditate." He was saying, "Go and do jhana practice. Go and get concentrated. Go and experience consciousness in this particular way. Go and get concentrated." And that appears at the end of loads of suttas when the Buddha had given a teaching, and then he would say, "Go and do that now. Go and get concentrated." So when you come out of the jhanas, when you finish a period of jhana practice, your mind is often much more concentrated, much more receptive, much sharper. And if you have the time, and again, this does take a lot of time, it's the perfect time to do insight practice. In fact, you could say that the jhanas could be seen as a warm-up practice for Satipatthana and for other insight practices. So I notice, for example, when I finish a period of jhana practice, that I'm much less egocentric, I have a much broader, flexible perspective. It's this lovely word in Pali. I have a strong sense of mudita, which means malleability, not mudita, which is sympathetic joy. So this sense of feeling really flexible, really malleable, you just feel that you're able just to broaden and break down your perspectives in such a way because you've been through these different states of concentration. So it's a really good opportunity to do some insight practice, maybe reflecting on something like impermanence, for example, because your mind is being concentrated in such a specific way. You're more open and more receptive to be able to have insights into other things. So a couple more things about the jhanas. In the commentaries, it speaks of there being five grades of piti, panchavana piti, which means five grades of piti, of this rapture or glee that I talked about. It's also translated sometimes as zest. I just think of lemons when I hear that. Zest or exuberance. But I'll stick with rapture or glee. So what are these five grades of PT? I'll say them in English. So there's minor PT, momentary, showering or burst of PT. There's uplifting PT, ubega PT. And then there's all-pervasive, or technical term would be full-blowing PT. So the commentaries speak of these five grades, and PT is like that. You feel it coming on, and you like work through its minor, momentary shower, and it comes and goes in little bursts. Then you start to really feel uplifted by it, and then it is full-on, and it's pervasive, and you could well be feeling really warm, and you could be laughing and smiling and all this kicking off. So it is important to know that there are these grades of PT that do get ratcheted up as you become more concentrated. And Sangharakshita, our founder and teacher, has talked a lot about the jhanas as well. And in the survey, he gives this lovely example that comes from the Digha Nikaya, from the Samanaphala Sutta. Yeah, so the Samanaphala Sutta, the fruits of being a Shramana or Samana, the fruits of being a holy person, basically, is what the sutta is about. And he gives these four similes which indicate the mode of permeation taking place. They indicate how your mind is being ever more concentrated by the jhana. So this is the first four jhanas. So in the sutta, it talks about there being a bath attendant who puts soap powder into a dish, and then he soaks it with water, and he mixes it all up and dissolves it so that the foam is completely permeated, saturated and moist. And in the text it says, just as a monk seduces, pervades, fills and permeates his body with pleasure and joy, first jhana, arising from seclusion, there is nothing in his body untouched by pleasure and joy arising from seclusion. So this image of this perfect mixture of the soap powder and the water until it pervades, fills and permeates. It's saturated. It's a lovely image. So for the second jhana, it describes a lake with a subterranean underground spring into which flows no river, and somehow the clouds don't rain into it either. So only the fresh spring at the bottom wells up and completely suffuses, pervades, fills and permeates, so that no part of the lake is left unsaturated with fresh water. Just as a monk permeates his body with pleasure and joy arising from concentration. So these are the similes that were used in the early texts. So for the third jhana, it describes a lake with lotus plants, and that some flowers were born in water, developing water, and some remain below the surface and draw their nourishment from the depths, and their blooms and roots are suffused, pervaded, filled and permeated with fresh water. Just as a monk permeates his body with pleasure and joy. And the fourth simile is, which I think is a lovely one, it's as a person might cloak themselves from head to foot in white cloth so that no part of the body is left uncovered. And just as a person sits having covered his body with a state of extreme equanimity and concentration. So it's just a lovely way of just describing in a more poetic way what these experiences are like. So just briefly looking at another sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya where this is talked about, and it's talked about 50 of them, so we could be here for some time, but I promise we won't be. This is the Salaka Sutta. Salaka is another one of those weird words which the most common translation is effacement. I didn't even know what that meant. I had to look up the English dictionary. What does effacement mean? To withdraw oneself, to wipe out, to do away with, to make oneself inconspicuous. And that is what Salaka translates as, but there's also a sense of austerity in there, of austere penance. So while it is called the Discourse on Effacement in English, I do find it helpful sometimes to think of it as austerity, so Discourse on Austerity. So in this context, it's probably easier to understand austerity than it is effacement, although you might find effacement works for you. I'll use austerity. And in this sutta, the Buddha mentions that people who experience the the first and the subsequent three jhanas, so the first four jhanas, they might think, I'm abiding in austerity, or I'm abiding in effacement. It doesn't sound right to me, so I'll use austerity. I'm abiding in austerity. But the Buddha cautions in this sutta that it is not these attainments that are called austerities in his teachings. He says that these are called pleasant abidings here and now in the practice of the Noble One. So basically, at the start of the sutta, it's saying the jhanas are not the be-all and end-all. As I mentioned at the very start, they're still mundane states of consciousness. So they're not the be-all and end-all, as Gautama, so the pre-Buddha's early teachers, mistakenly thought. This is the be-all and end-all. Well, no, they're not. And the Buddha points that out time and time again in numerous different texts. So this Salaka Sutta is talking about practices that are deeply transformative. They do actually change the structure of our psyche in a meaningful way. So he's talking about practices that are really transformative rather than practices that only offer a temporary respite. And he says that formal meditation practice may be pleasant, but it doesn't help transform our character in a deep, abiding and permanent way. He acknowledges that rarefied states of focused meditation may contribute to the process of us changing our actions, our intentions, our behaviours, our dispositions. But he also suggests that the practice of austerity is necessary too, hence the name of the sutta. And the sutta goes on to produce a long list of 44 unhealthy states that I've no intention of repeating because we'll be here for half the day. But it's a really good sutta, and these states are repeated throughout the sutta in different contexts, just to drive home the meaning of them. So these practices that I've talked about this morning, talking about the jhanas, these practices enable us to abide peacefully here and now. And they help a restless or sluggish mind. And they do start us on the road to transformation. And, hey, it is good for us to abide pleasantly in the here and now. There's nothing wrong with that. There is such a thing as healthy pleasure, and the jhanas point directly towards that. So one of the benefits of meditation is that from time to time, as regularly as possible, we allow ourselves to settle into the moment. So if we're able to move towards a more regular meditation practice, we allow ourselves to settle on a more regular basis. And that's a real benefit, because although it may not transform the fundamental causes of our afflictive emotions, it does grant a temporary respite from the difficult aspects of our lives and of our being, of our personalities. So that's all I'm going to say. I guess an ending word would be, I'll encourage you all to be jhanarata, which means fond of meditation. So go be jhanarata, because it does help, it is transformative, and it does give us a completely different perspective on life. So yeah, that's all I'm going to say on the jhanas.